Welcome to the Beverage Report. I'm your host, Reza Rasool, and today I'm delighted to have Professor Imran Rasool with me. Professor Rasool is a professor for economics at University College London, co-director of the Center for Microeconomic Analysis of Public Policy at the Institute for Fiscal Studies, IFS, and co-president of the Bureau for Research on Economic Analysis of Development. He's also a fellow of the British Academy and received an OBE for his services to social sciences. In this episode, we will talk about his research on labour, development and public economics, and how he applies economic theory and empirical methods to address policy-relevant questions.
Let's jump right into it. So, my first question to you is, what motivated you to pursue a PhD in economics, and what is your fondest memory from during your time at LSE?
Well, first of all, Reza, thank you for inviting me the podcast today. So in terms of what motivated me to study economics and then go on to the LSE, I mean, in school, I basically had a love of maths and politics. My school only offered an A-level that combined politics and economics. So in a sense, I was forced to do economics right from that age. But that's when I understood that economics was like a perfect place to actually apply many mathematical tools to understand not just economic problems, but fundamentally political problems as well. And so that's when I really became hooked. And then I had the chance to be a research assistant for Professor Chris Scott, who was a professor at LSE at the time. And, you know, that experience really convinced me that research was something that I wanted to do. And then when I applied to do the PhD, that was Tim Besney had also decided to stay at LSE at that time. And, you know, I managed to convince him to be my advisor. And so everything just fell into place. And so that's basically how I got started. In terms of fondest memories, I mean, there were some great professors I remember who taught us. Maurice Perlman, Chris Pissarides, Vasilis Hadjivasiliou were like all fantastic, motivating professors to learn from. I've made many good friends on the PhD program, lifelong friends. And of course, that's where I met my wife as well. So many good memories.
Awesome. And your website showcases some incredible photographs. What is your favorite subject to capture and why?
Yeah, so I've always enjoyed photography. And, you know, I've been very lucky in my life to be able to travel to many places. So to use that as an opportunity just to remember the places and good times is always nice. My favorite subject, I would like to take more pictures of my family, but normally they run away as soon as I point a camera at them. So most of the pictures you'll see are of nature and sort of an appreciation of the natural world around us.
Awesome. Moving on to some academic questions. You are on the panel of the IFS Teaching Review, focusing on understanding inequalities. How have historical factors such as colonialism impacted the current state of ethnic inequalities in the UK? And what actions can be taken to address the legacy of these issues?
So it's clear that different groups in the UK have arrived with very different sort of legacies, different skills. As a result, they've moved into different sectors. But I think one of the sort of stark realities that the Deakin Review really puts forward is the persistence of some of these inequalities across generations, 2-3 generations later, from those foreign-born individuals who arrive from a variety of settings. And so it's as much to do with individuals who've been born and brought up in the UK. Why do we still observe persistent inequalities for those generations as well as for older foreign-born generations? And so the Deakin Review, you know, highlights some success stories if we think about educational advancement of minorities in the compulsory schooling system. A number of them have overtaken attainment of majority population. Many others have closed the gap. The one exception is sort of Black Caribbean children who seem to be diverging away. So there's some very concerning patterns that we see in the data. But the Deakin Review also highlights that a lot of that educational attainment for many groups hasn't necessarily translated into labor market progression. So really understanding what's causing those blockages and leads to the persistence of minorities to concentrate in some sectors, in sort of a greater reliance on self-employment, still remains very key. So that intergenerational transmission of inequality seems to be very important. So obviously historical legacies have an element to play, but the Digital Review highlights many points in the here and now where policy can potentially have great impact on narrowing some of these inequalities, and essentially meaning that your ethnic background is not such a key determinant of the job that you end up doing, the success that you have in the labor market, and the wealth that you might be able to accumulate over your life.
Interesting. And you mentioned that policy can have an important role to play in reducing the inequalities. What is a recent policy measure that you think is quite crucial in order to reduce inequalities in the UK and abroad?
Well, some of these issues really stem from transitions from education into the labor market. So whether young people from minority backgrounds face some particular barriers or a lack of information, or some other frictions that prevent them moving into various types of employment might seem to be key. The consequences of this were really laid out very barely during the pandemic, where we saw big differences open up across minorities, not just in terms of worse health outcomes as a result of the pandemic, but those really stemming from long-lasting, persistent inequalities in terms of housing quality, the types of work that people were able to are typically employed in, which may be more susceptible to lockdowns. So these issues are really sort of intertwined in terms of health differentials, you know, economic differentials. So policy can act on many of those different margins potentially, but we're trying to set out a new program of work building from the Digital Review to really get to the heart of some of those issues and exactly where policy can intervene most effectively. Some of this stems back to the fact that, you know, minorities often, you know, almost by construction have less housing wealth, for example. And housing wealth is a key way in which intergenerationally one generation can pass on transfers to another generation. And so that may be quite different across different minorities relative to the majority. So there are important issues about how minorities are able to accumulate wealth, whether it's through housing wealth or a lack of accumulation of pension wealth because of an over-reliance, say, on self-employment activities.
And based on your findings that both vocational training and firm-provided training have a positive impact on reducing unemployment in Uganda, and vocational training actually has a longer-lasting impact, to what extent do findings in Uganda carry over to the developed world?
Okay, so vocational training and firm-provided training are two of the most common ways that individuals can acquire skills once they leave the education system. And it's useful to try to compare these two ways of acquiring human capital because vocational training is essentially supply-side policy where workers themselves pay to get trained in formal institutions. And firm-provided training is sort of a main firm-side or demand-side way in which firms can potentially be incentivized to give workers skills. And so we wanted to have a long-run comparison of the differences in these two ways of acquiring skills. And as you mentioned, we find that in the longer term, vocational training tends to have more persistent impacts. Now, the reasons for that are related to some context-specific features in Uganda that then do apply in other settings. Let me be really clear about what those sort of features are. The two types of workers end up with actually very similar sets of skills, whether they acquire them through a formal training program or whether firms are incentivized to train a similar group of individuals within the firm, that the skills of workers are actually not that different. What is the key distinction is that when an individual acquires skills through a vocational training institute, they graduate with a piece of paper, they graduate with a certificate, and that allows them to essentially certify their skills in a credible way, and then they can use that certification as a way to transmit to other potential employers that I have these skills. If you're trained within a firm, you don't have that level of certification. And so that makes it very hard when workers are looking for new jobs, or either because they're trying to move from job to job or they become unemployed. If you can't signal that you have those skills, then it's much harder for you to continue progressing in the labor market. Vocational trainees, as a result, are more likely to be able to move from one job to another job because they have those certified skills. If they become unemployed, they spend much less time in unemployment and are much more likely to get back onto the job ladder than workers with similar skills, but who acquired those skills through a different route and can't demonstrate credibly that they have those skills. So the key sort of policy friction that causes this difference is that in economies where workers can't signal their skills, either through being able to demonstrate what their labor market history is, having a CV or a credible reference, with those types of information frictions, the returns to certification are going to be very high. So in many developing countries, we see that kind of problem being quite common. But still, the ability of workers to signal their skills is a classic problem that's been studied in many contexts, including in high-income settings. The nature of the problem may be slightly different, but fundamentally, there are things that a worker might have that are firm values, but if a worker can't credibly signal those traits that they have, then you would expect also some inefficiencies to occur as a result of that.
Interesting. Your research has also shown that worker productivity can vary based on their workplace social network. With the rise of remote work, do you think these findings still hold true?
Yeah, so I think the changes in technology that we observe are causing differences in how workers interact with their colleagues and moving from an offline world into an online world. I think it's hard to say what will happen to productivity as a result. I think there's going to be various forces. On the one hand, moving to online work allows people to potentially extend their network and actually connect with more individuals, not just based on physical proximity, but a wider range of individuals. On the other hand, you know, having actual sort of in-person meetings can generate a different set of ideas that perhaps are less scripted or more ad hoc. And so if there are real productivity impacts of those types of interactions, then that force goes in the other direction. I can speak from an academic point of view and think about the production of research. And you can clearly see that, you know, moving more to sort of Zoom meetings or Teams meetings has both costs and benefits for decisions that are made in groups and the ability to generate and sort of sustain new ideas. So it's unclear what will be the overall productivity effects. I think they vary quite a lot across different parts of the economy, depending on the importance of teamwork, depending on the importance of ideas generation, innovation in different jobs and sectors.
Interesting. And in your personal experience in academia, do you think the benefits outweigh the costs?
I think that the impacts are really heterogeneous across individuals and the type of work that you're doing. And that's putting to one side all the environmental benefits of moving more to an online world. It's really hard to, I think, really have a key sort of overall net impact. It's going to vary across individuals and the nature of work that they're doing. And that would apply in the private and public sectors as well, in terms of jobs vary in terms of their importance of teamwork, of networking, and really fundamentally, you know, how important is it just to have random interactions with people that weren't planned that can actually lead to long-run ideas and new outcomes? I mean, that's a very hard thing to evaluate. I think we're just beginning to see the broad patterns of those shifts and how workers are often combining, you know, working from home and working in the office, and perhaps that would generate the best of all worlds.
In your research on women's empowerment, you found that providing vocational training and information on sex, reproduction, and marriage improves the well-being of adolescent girls over a four-year horizon. I was wondering, how do you think these results translate into the long-term effects?
So in that study in Uganda, the sort of the target population were girls who were essentially transitioning from adolescence into adulthood. You know, whenever we study sort of economics across the life cycle, transitions at various moments in your life are really important for your long-term outcomes. And the transition from adolescence into adulthood and moving into the labor market is one that's really, really key. And that's certainly the case in the Ugandan context. So the intervention that we evaluated, which was providing a combination of hard skills or vocational type training, as well as soft skills related to health and reproductive knowledge, those have big impacts in terms of the timing of decisions that girls are making. They're delaying childbearing, they're delaying entering into relationships. And that can have long-term benefits because it just opens up a window of opportunity in which they can acquire more labor market experience, more labor market attachment, improve their skills. That from a whole range of studies, just those small delays at that point of transition can have these longer term impacts over the life cycle. So I'd imagine there to be long term effects of that intervention. In fact, I've emphasized the transition into the labor market another aspect that we document in the paper is that having small delays in those kinds of important decisions also allows girls potentially to migrate away from rural to more urban areas. So it's also opening up different opportunities in terms of geographic location, the types of jobs, types of economic environment in which people are able to move into. Again, that could potentially have very long-term impacts across people's lives.
Interesting. What do you feel has been the most significant development resulting from your research?
So I throughout my career, I've been really lucky to work with some very inspiring NGOs. For example, I've been able to partner with BRAC, with Save the Children, with the Pakistani Poverty Alleviation Fund, for example. All of these are incredibly well motivated and scientifically based organizations, and so some of the evaluations we've been able to conduct have led to policies either being scaled up or the design of those policies being refined in a way to make them more cost effective, and in some cases it's led to policies actually being dropped because they just aren't as effective or there's a better use of those resources. So perhaps a good example is sort of the evaluation of an ultra-poor asset transfer program that we conducted with BRAC in Bangladesh. That was an evaluation that started in 2007, and we published some work looking at the seven-year impacts of providing the ultra-poor assets primarily in the form of livestock combined with training. And the program was very cost-effective. It really had transformative impacts on the households it was targeted towards. And so that program has since been expanded, to hundreds of thousands of households in Bangladesh. It's been exported to other countries by BRAC. Other agencies, including the UNHCR and other NGOs, have taken up the program. So not all of that is because of, our evaluation, but that was an important element in building the case for that type of intervention to provide people assets as being an effective way to take people out of poverty in the longer term. So I think that was one example which I'm particularly proud of that had a long-term impact.
Interesting. It'd be really fascinating to hear your experience, how you went about collecting data. As I saw in a few research questions that you were looking at RCTs. And I'm just wondering if you could paint a picture for us, how do you go about collecting that data in the first place? How do you build those connections in the nations that you're working in?
So the most important piece of advice I often give my students when they're starting to partner with an organization and think about conducting, say, an experimental evaluation, sort of two things. The first is, what's in it for the partner organization? What do they really want to know? Because as economists, we have great ways of answering questions. We're not always completely on top of exactly what's the most relevant question to ask. And so, just being able to listen to your partner organization are much more used to the context and really understanding what might be the key constraints that are preventing people reaching their full potential is really important, and really make it into a long-term partnership. I mean, something that I've always tried to do with many of the NGOs that I've been able to work with is not just engage with them in the short term, but really think about long-run evaluations. Because I think as economists, that's one of our key comparative advantages, to really think about dynamic impacts of interventions, how the short run can be very different than the long run, and how the long run can then translate even into intergenerational impacts for some types of policy, which are important for us to really price those policies correctly. So that's sort of one element in terms of managing the relationship and making sure that it's a win-win situation for everybody. The second element that I always stress to my students, and through my own mistakes and experiences, for any given evaluation, there can be potentially many, many questions you'd like to answer. You, from the outset, have to determine which questions you really want to answer and which questions are you willing to give up and not try to answer. And that's a really hard decision to make, because you'd like, ideally like to do everything, but we're subject to budget constraints, we're subject to time constraints. So, making an attempt to answer a whole range of questions typically ends in failure and not being able to answer at least one of them well. And so it's a matter of really having a focus and saying, this is really what I want to be able to answer. And then translating that particular question into what type of data you want to collect is a process that you really want to take very carefully and step by step. We have a lot of theory to guide us in terms of what are the types of things that we should be trying to collect, either as in terms of mechanisms or as key outcomes. That's often led me to the conclusion that many of the things that we think of as being second nature in many of the models that we write down, do still have major important difficulties in actually thinking about how to measure some of these concepts. So a good one that you know is relevant for what we've been discussing before in terms of vocational training is, you know, a key concept that Becker introduces, the, you know, is the distinction between general skills and firm specific skills. We could write down a model where we might sort of classify a worker's skills into those two types, but to actually measure what skills are general, what skills are firm specific, is a really, really difficult problem. And it's something that we've been doing trying to do for years. And so those are things that I actually find really interesting as well. And a lot of colleagues at UCL are very much sort of engaged in how do we actually measure some of these key concepts accurately? And, you know, trialing new things and understanding whether measures of skills or measures of human capital accumulation are actually accurate measures of what we'd really like to do, I think is a very challenging but really important part of that whole process of setting up an RCT. Really mapping from the theory to what you'd like to measure, what you can actually measure, and then, you know, all wrapped around a core set of questions that you're actually attempting to answer, and be willing to say this study is not going to be able to answer this question. That's a really bitter pill to have to swallow from day one, but unless you do that, you're often going to end up with a worse study as a result.
And what research questions are you most interested in right now?
So one project that we've been doing in Pakistan is to understand what drives the demand for good policies. So this arose from many years of frustration that many of the interventions we've been evaluating, you know, if you find that they're beneficial for the recipients, cost effective from society's point of view, say through an annualized internal rate of return. You know, when you talk to policymakers and say that, you know, this is a very high return policy, it's very hard to convince them just on the basis of that they should implement or scale up this policy. So as a result, I got interested a few years ago to really understand, you know, what drives the demand for good policies from a voter's perspective. And so there we've been really trying to understand in the context of development interventions that we know are effective and cost effective. How does that change views about redistribution, about inequality, about social capital, belief in the market, all of those kinds of economic preferences, how do those change once you demonstrate the effectiveness of a policy? We do this in the context of rural economies in Pakistan, where we survey both beneficiaries and non-beneficiaries in relatively small villages to really understand whether if you have a poverty alleviation program that's effective in your village, do the poor, for example, become more supportive of similar policies being expanded, or do they become less supportive because now they've gained, they don't need to support these policies as much? And how do the wealthier households in the village react? So that's just trying to really understand where do people's economic preferences come from. And unfortunately, the results seem to suggest that the mere demonstration of good and effective policies that impact outcomes that we care about, such as wealth or income, don't seem to have much long-lasting effects on people's economic preferences, either of the beneficiaries themselves or of non-beneficiaries who get to observe all of these benefits in occurring to others in the village.
So what are the early hypotheses of what really impacts?
So now I'm back to square one, because I was hoping the results from this paper would be much more positive. And so this gets me back to another line of work that I've been thinking about, which is sort of the intergenerational transmission of preferences and early life experiences and how they might shape longer term preferences. So we have some more recent work from Sierra Leone, for example, looking at individuals who were born during the Sierra Leonean Civil War and how they were potentially exposed to conflict or different types of violence, and how that shapes their long-run preferences to trust in others, for example. And that's got me thinking about this line of research about sort of traumatic or big events that happen early in life or through childhood and into adolescence. How do those kinds of experiences then translate into the hardwiring of certain preferences or views of the world later in life? And, you know, then do those become very difficult to shift later in life? And are there sort of some key stages where these preferences form? That's a big agenda going forward. That's an example where trying to measure some of these concepts is actually quite difficult. And so it's really nice to be able to work with psychologists or, you know, with theorists who are thinking about how do we form views of the world about what we believe, what we expect, who we trust, what we think is sort of right or wrong in terms of what government should do. So there's lots to do there.
You mentioned a lot of interesting work that you're currently conducting. What impact do you hope your research will have?
That's really hard for me to say, but I hope that, in any given piece of research, it can have sort of limited impact. But if you see the whole body of work together, you can potentially think, oh, this combination of policies would dominate this combination, or hopefully people can take that evidence and feed it in to building the case for some types of policy being more effective than others. But always with the caveat that the same policy could have hugely differential effects across different contexts. And so that's something that we always sort of conscious of in the work that we do, and really trying to understand what are the fundamentals that are driving the results, and in which context would those fundamentals not be present, or would they actually be the other way around, and so all the impacts might be reversed. So not just talk about any particular context, but try to use that to then say how might this policy then operate differently in other places as well. So hopefully over time that has some impact on the way that individuals think about the world.
Awesome. What advice would you give to students looking to pursue a career in economics?
I think it's a if that's your passion, then I would really encourage any young person to become an economist. I think it's a wonderful way to discipline your thoughts and understand the world, and the world is not always the way that we would like it to be. And so really understanding what's preventing it moving in those directions is really an enjoyable sort of process. I think it's a wonderful time to be an economist because of at least two reasons. One is, economics has really been transformed over the last 20 years. It's become a much more empirical discipline, much more focused on really identifying causal relationships. That kind of credibility revolution continues to this day. But it's also important to always combine theory, evidence, and structure to really understand, what would have happened in a counterfactual scenario. We have an avalanche of data that's now becoming available. And so the possibilities to study issues has never been greater. But ultimately, sort of looking back, I still think it's the case that, the great challenges that most societies face, whether it's sort of climate change, understanding persistence of inequalities, the erosion of democratic norms, all of these great sort of societal issues, very much economists have something to contribute to all of those issues. But in a sense, we can contribute even more if we work with other people in social science, in natural science, to really get the most in terms of what we can potentially do to address the causes and consequences of some of these big changes. And many societies are grappling with some, if not all, of these issues. And some of my research has sort of touched upon some of those issues in the past. And I think that's been hugely rewarding to see how that little bit of work fits into the bigger picture of our understanding of how we might solve some of these issues.
Finally, something we ask every guest on the podcast: what gives you hope?
Lots of things give me hope. I've been really fortunate to work with great PhD students, undergraduate students, master students, early career researchers, fantastic colleagues, but not just in academia, but also, to interact with really, motivated, talented people in NGOs and government agencies and in government more broadly. So I think, there's this fundamental, very strong demand still for understanding economics and using economics as a tool for good. And seeing that arc or that coalition of academics, NGOs, government, coming together to really say, how can we best use this to make the world a better place? I still see that, as I was saying, there's lots of challenges, obviously, we face in society. I think that economics has a role to play in that. And, that we're not going to play that role just by standing on the sidelines. Everybody needs to get involved and contribute in the way that they find most appropriate. But, we have the ability to do that. It's a very privileged position. And as long as we're aware of the limits of what we can say, I think it's a very powerful discipline that's full of great new young people coming along with ideas and doing things that I would have thought were impossible to do, 20 years ago when I got my PhD. So it's just wonderful to see that and just being able to work with people like that.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.